KaiserNetwork.org.
Good morning and welcome to this forum today to assess the Medicare Drug Benefit Program from the perspective of the implementation of the low-income subsidy and the transition of the dual eligibles, the two groups who qualify for low-income assistance under the new Part D program of Medicare. What we wanted to do today was to really reflect on the milestones that have been now passed in the implementation of Part D. First, January 1st of 2006, which was the launch of coverage for the Part D of the program, as well as the transition for over 6 million dual eligibles, those covered by both Medicare and Medicaid, from receiving their drug assistance through the Medicaid program to coverage under Part D. And now we've achieved a second milestone. We've hit the May 15th, 2006 deadline for enrollment and the penalty going into effect for those who have failed to sign up by this time. But as part of this forum today, we really wanted to focus on not the overall Part D benefit for the 43 million Medicare beneficiaries, but on those that receive and are eligible to receive assistance because of their low incomes. And as you all know, we do have an array of ways in which individuals who are on Medicare are now receiving their drug coverage. Some, because of employer and retiree benefits or union coverage, are deemed to have credible coverage and are receiving their drug benefits as a credible coverage individuals. Others are now estimated to have credible coverage even though they may not have had an official letter and their employer may not be getting any subsidy assistance from the federal government. And then we have many who have not signed up and who we don't think have credible coverage, 6.2 million. But what we're focusing on today is really the group that covers that are receiving coverage as dual eligibles and those who receive low-income subsidies within the Part D plans, where you see that 20.7 million people are now estimated as of May 7. I know the number's probably changing every day and going up, but we're looking here at the dual eligible individuals who had Medicaid coverage previously and are now shifted into Medicare, as well as those who have received and signed up for coverage and receiving the low-income subsidy, as well as those who may be eligible for the low-income subsidy and are not yet covered. And so basically today we're looking at around 13.2 million beneficiaries now estimated by HHS to be eligible for low-income assistance that helps with both the premiums and with the cost-sharing levels. And we're looking at 6.4 million who are dual eligibles receiving the subsidy automatically, another group of dual eligibles who are part of the Medicare savings programs or are SSI recipients who are also automatically receiving the subsidy. And then we're looking at, and B. Desmond will be here to discuss with us the numbers, those who are found eligible by the Social Security Administration to receive the subsidy, that's 1.7 million. Another 1 million are estimated to have credible coverage among the low-income potential eligibles for the subsidy. But that leaves 3.2 million who are considered eligible but not receiving the subsidy. Those were the individuals for whom much of the Medicare Part D bill was intended to provide direct assistance. And so part of our challenge today is to look at how to reach that 3.2 million and what efforts are being done there. We're going to have a lot of information that's in your packet that we're not going to present or discuss, but we hope you'll take time to review. There are new fact sheets on dual eligibles, on the low-income subsidy, on the Medicare drug benefit itself, and we have two new reports that we've included. One that will be highlighted a little today are the observations of some of the state Medicaid directors on the implementation issues with regard to coverage of the dual eligibles. And I want to call your attention to a second report that focuses on a baseline comparison of the low-income subsidy eligibility requirements versus the Medicare savings programs and some of the disconnects that may be occurring there. But what we'd like to do today is to really have a good panel discussion about how this program is being implemented, what some of the choices and challenges are for the low-income population. And I think we've assembled just a terrific panel to help us through the issues related to coverage for low-income individuals. We're going to have Bea Desmond, who is the New York Regional Commissioner and Chair of the Medicare Task Force at the Social Security Administration, who has been, of course, directly involved with trying to provide for the coverage and assess the coverage possibilities for individuals applying for the low-income subsidy. We have Michael McMillan, the Deputy Director of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, to provide us with a CMS perspective. And I'd like to give a round of applause to Michael today, as this is her last official act before her retirement from CMS. We thank her for all of her dedicated service over, I think, 31 years, is it? 32 years, and I hope it wasn't the Part D benefit that drove her into retirement, but she can comment on that later. We are joined by Marilyn Moon, the Vice President and Director of the Health Program of the American Institutes for Research, and as we know, a noted expert on the Medicare program. John Rother, the Director of Policy and Strategy for AARP, which has some interest in how the Part D program is going for the beneficiaries. And finally, Vern Smith, Principal of Health Management Associates, who has been doing work with us to assess the perspectives of the Medicaid directors, who can provide some insights into how the dual eligible side of this equation is going. But before we launch into our panel discussion, we wanted to share with you a video that has been produced by Jackie Judd of the Kaiser Family Foundation that is actually a follow-up to one that we showed earlier on dual eligibles and some of their issues and concerns. As you know, most duals were automatically enrolled in coverage plans by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. Others made their own selections. And in 2005, we produced a video exploring some of the concerns that some dual eligibles had about this transition. This latest video, produced in 2006, follows up with these individuals on what their experiences have been now that the program has been enacted and what challenges they may face as insurers reevaluate their plans every year and they try to figure out what their coverage is going to be. So we really want you to hear their voices first, and then we're going to turn to our panel. So if we could have the video, please.
Charles Strickland had a sense of dread last year about the transition he faced.
My medical expenses completely covered. Now that's paradise. Now, what's coming is something short of paradise, and so the alarm bells are starting to ring a little bit in there.
Today, Strickland says his concern was well-founded.
Well, the enrollment process was actually a nightmare, and for the seniors in my complex, it was definitely the winner of our discontent.
Strickland is on both Medicaid and Medicare. In January, coverage of prescription drugs for him and the more than 6 million other so-called duals shifted from Medicaid to Medicare's new drug plans. Strickland was overwhelmed with the complexity of the process, and he says angered by false promises about what the plan's copays would cost him.
Representatives were sent to our complex from different HMOs, and we weren't given good information all the time. Sometimes they said we would not have to pay copays, and of course we found out that we did have to pay copays.
Strickland, who lives in South Florida on a fixed income, takes 8 to 9 different medications a day for heart disease and other ailments. His monthly bill has gone from zero under the state's Medicaid program to $20. He is now on his second Medicare drug plan and is searching for a third that he hopes will be cheaper.
I, too, am on a very limited income, and it makes it very difficult, and I think that I I probably am going to have to cut out two or three of the medications that I need the least.
Judy Shipley, who has disabilities resulting from encephalitis, has had an entirely different experience.
Did you have any problems in moving from one program to the other in January?
No, I didn't have a lot of problems.
Shipley's friend from her days as a business executive in Baltimore took charge and made all the right decisions. The monthly cost and the pharmacy remain the same. It has been a seamless process.
What did she choose for you?
I don't exactly know what plan it is. I have a little card which has a number and everything on it, because when my prescriptions are due, they just show up.
But even informed friends and professionals don't always get it right.
The second time, I kind of got angry and got frustrated, and I didn't do anything for a couple of weeks. I just kind of shut down.
Steve Yorkman has a complex medical history involving heart disease, diabetes, and bipolar disorder. He's dependent on 11 prescription drugs.
Thank you for calling Medicare.
Like many duals, the government automatically enrolled him in a plan. It fell short, very short.
It only covered four of my medications, yeah.
And how did you find that out?
When I went to the pharmacy to pick up my medications, and then they told me that I owed them $496 for the balance, and I was like, I don't have $496, and how did it get to be so much? And then they told me these other ones weren't covered.
Yorkman turned to his doctor, who helped him select plan number two.
You know, on paper, it looked like it covered everything, but evidently it still didn't cover everything.
This one covered 8 of his 11 medications. Yorkman missed taking some of his drugs as he shifted between plans. It made him anxious but did not lead to more serious health consequences. He is now enrolled in a third plan, which seems to be the right one. Yorkman is getting the drugs he needs at about the same cost that he paid under Medicaid. But the past few months have been unsettling in a profound way.
I don't feel like they have my back. You know, one time I felt like they kind of had my back. The system was there to have my back, to keep me from, like, falling all the way down. I don't feel like that anymore. I feel like the system will just let you fall down.
It was a frightening, frustrating process for Steve Yorkman, a process that could begin anew as plans decide each year what drugs to cover, what prices to charge, and whether to stay in the program at all.
So it's about transitions. And I guess my first question would go to you, Vern, in terms of, here we heard from 3 dual eligibles about their experiences in this transition. I know you've heard from the states about their side. How are things out there? Are they getting better? Are these the kinds of issues that continue? What are some of the concerns that you've heard from the Medicaid directors and some of the success stories?
Oh, well, where to start? Well, first of all, thank you. And the video probably said all of this better than I could have, actually. When we speak to the Medicaid directors, of course, we're focusing on the dual eligibles and those individuals that are on both Medicare and Medicaid at the same time. It is probably worth saying that this is a group with very, very high health needs and prescription drug needs. When Medicaid directors look at this particular group just in terms of Medicaid cost, this has far and away been the most expensive group on Medicaid. And when people on Medicare look at this group, this is the most expensive group on Medicare as well, just in terms of Medicare costs. So clearly this is a group with it's frail, very high and complex healthcare needs, and their prescription needs are very, very significant. So it was important that this transition for this group from a Medicaid coverage, which has been comprehensive and secure, to the Part D coverage be done in a way which was flawless. it had to be flawless because the needs are so significant. And what we found, of course, in January was that it wasn't flawless. I think almost uniformly people in the States would describe January and to a certain extent February as a period of chaos. There was a lot of difficulty with the transitions. The data didn't match up. People who were supposed to be enrolled were not actually enrolled. People went to get their prescription drugs and discovered that the card that worked in December didn't work in January. And so there were a lot of issues there, and states jumped in very quickly because states have ownership of this population, have had ownership, and wanted to make sure that the drugs that were necessary for their health were actually covered. And so about three-fourths of the states jumped in and created plans that were a backstop to the coverage. And CMS, to its credit, jumped in and offered to reimburse states for that through March. And so that provided something of a backstop up to that point in time. Things are better now, but things are not yet perfect. It's not flawless yet. And maybe the most, there are several maybe indicators of how states continue to see a need here. California this week announced, Governor Schwarzenegger announced that California was going to extend its emergency program to cover drugs and copays that were not covered by Part D plans that should be covered by Part D plans through January 31st of next year. Other states are doing things similar, all at state costs, because there's no federal money available for that after March. So I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't go on, but we could go on.
Well, Michael, do you think these dual issues have been resolved? Are you seeing still a continued need to really respond? And I guess more importantly, since we know this program will go on, there'll be a new series of plans perhaps consolidating. What do you anticipate as some of the challenges in the future around this population?
When you look at what needed to be done to make it work, the CMS and all of the states had to get information, and the law required us to randomly assign people to plans. So some of what you saw in the video was that people were assigned not necessarily on the basis of their health experience or medication needs, but randomly based on what the statute required so that they would be in a plan where they didn't have to pay a premium. And that's also why the full benefit dual eligibles and the partial dual eligibles can change plans, as you heard in the video. And what we did to try to facilitate that was work with the states and with community-based organizations who could support people in trying to find the plans that match their needs. So that's what's going on, and I think that that has improved with time and will continue to improve. Now, what will happen in the future is that as we transition to plan year 2007, people will be rolled over into the plan that they're in if their plan has or if their organization has a plan with premiums below the minimum, which we expect that they will, so they won't have to leave their plan. If, however, they are faced with a premium, we will automatically assign them to a different plan and give them sufficient time before January 1st to re-enroll in the plan that they're in if they so choose, understanding that they may have to pay the differential of the premium because the subsidy is for the base premium and they would have to pay the differential, or to select another plan. So we are trying very hard to identify ways to make the transition as seamless as possible within the statutory mandates.
But we also anticipate that there may be far fewer plans out there next year with plan consolidation. So there could be a substantial amount of churning going on within this population.
Well, it's hard to tell. The bids from the plans are due in early June, and that's when we'll know what the plan horizon looks like. There's lots of speculations on both sides. There'll be consolidation, there'll be more plans in the marketplace, so it's too early to tell that.
And in terms of those who are not dual eligible, so they're not automatically enrolled, the Part D benefit extends some substantial assistance to other low-income individuals through the subsidy program, a major feature of the bill that was intended to really direct assistance to those with the lowest income, yet we see that about 3.2 million of those who are eligible do not appear to be receiving the subsidy. B, can you comment on sort of who's gotten the subsidy, how they're getting it, how well that's gone, and what you think some of the challenges are to reaching those who are still out there but not yet covered?
Well, thank you. I really appreciate being with you today. As you know, I came in from New York City especially to do this because I consider our discussion about the low-income subsidy, those that are not duals, very, very significant, and among our most vulnerable population. It also is a very difficult population to reach. And we have not, in Social Security, focused on the numbers. We are really focusing on trying to reach everyone who is eligible. And I think if you look at it, I just want to refresh you as to what we've done and what we will be doing, because I think for everyone, we just need to be clear that there is no deadline for filing for the low-income subsidy. As a matter of fact, based on CMS and HHS, the penalty has been waived for all of 2006 for someone that enrolls after May 15th. And actually files with Social Security after May 15th or the states. So this is a real significant period for us to continue our focus and to continue our effort to try to reach this population. Let me go back a little and talk about approaches. In Social Security, we knew one approach would not fit all. We did multiple approaches. I think you all know we did that targeted mailing and cast a very large net. We then did follow-up phone calls to almost 9 million individuals, did follow-up letters to that population. But we knew private-public partnerships were going to be very significant, and on-the-ground efforts were going to be very significant. So to date, we've done over 73,000 events in the communities and with states, and we're continuing to do that. We're continuing to do outreach. We're looking to do targeted outreach to try to really focus on obtaining applications from the eligible population. You know, we also have people calling our 800 number and visiting our field offices. And, you know, we all talk about outreach, but we also talk about inreach. We want to make sure that when you call us or visit us, that we discuss the low-income subsidy with people with limited income and resources. We think also that's a very significant lead because you've been in touch with us. We need to take it one step further. We're also doing a number of other events in the community. We're still sending some targeted letters from our field offices inviting people in to file. And we're starting phone calls. As a matter of fact, we did a special study based on data given to us from CMS, which was the people that received the $600 credit for the discount card. We wanted to see if we segmented the population that received it. Would people file and would they be eligible? So we are starting an initiative for people that are disabled as well as people that are age 75 or older because it appeared that was a very significant population for us to go the extra mile to reach out. In addition, we just completed a mailing to our disability beneficiaries, over 1.5 million. It was a different kind of letter because people with disabilities are always worried about their Social Security disability benefits. And we really wanted to emphasize to them that getting the low-income subsidy really has no impact on their Social Security disability. And I have to tell you, we've received a very positive response from that. In addition, we have about 3.6 million letters that are getting ready to go to our Medicare savings potential population. You know, we do that every year. Last year, we mailed 4.2 million. We'll be starting this May 22nd. We'll be mailing 190,000 letters a day until the end of June. And what these letters talk about is Medicare savings programs as well as the extra help, and also gives people an understanding of where to file the extra help and how to access the various channels with us. In addition, we are going to be testing another special mailing. We're trying to use data that we have to see if we can further identify targeted population, people that we sent the first application to that still has not responded or we haven't spoken to them and they haven't indicated. Because the number of people we speak to, they tell us they have too much income, they have too much resources. So we are going to be doing a test mailing to a very specific population, probably in the middle or late June, with a different type of letter, sending out the application again. And what it will probably be is to a population that has represented payees, because we kind of see if you have represented payee, you tend to have a higher eligibility rate for that. We're also looking to see the age. The older you are, we're really focused on people that are over 79 years of age, and then we'll be looking over 75 years of age, because, again, people at that age tend to meet the requirements that were established. In addition, we're still working with AARP, ABC Coalition, third parties, and I would offer to all of you, we're willing to listen to any new initiatives, any thoughts that you have. We're in for the long haul, and you will continue to see us in the communities to do the targeted events that I mentioned.
Well, John, back in 2003, AARP support helped put the legislation over the top, and the low-income assistance was a key factor in your support of the legislation. What do you think have been some of the barriers to getting more people to participate here, and what do you think can be done to really make this a reality for many of the low-income people that you helped get this legislation to assist?
Diane, first of all, thank you for holding the session and for all of the terrific work that the Kaiser Family Fund has been doing to stay on top of this issue this year. An opening observation is simply that we didn't pay enough attention to implementation issues when the legislation was being put together, quite obviously. I think that if you recall, the House bill was the one that put the duals in Medicare, and the Senate bill had them stay in Medicaid. And I think from an advocacy point of view, it was almost unanimous that we felt that these were people who had paid in over their lifetime, they had earned a benefit, and we saw some very disturbing trends in the states of Florida, Missouri, South Carolina, where Mississippi, where there were very serious cutbacks on the table for the Medicaid population, and we really felt that they would be much more protected and much more secure with a Medicare benefit. So given that, though, I have to say, we didn't really think through how to make it happen. I mean, who in their right mind would have started this program on a Sunday followed by a national holiday? So we are learning a lot in retrospect about implementation. I think when it comes to low-income seniors, there's some very obvious problems, and it's not just for this program, but for all low-income programs, including Medicaid. This is hard-to-reach population, and they're hard to reach for a reason. One of the reasons is literacy skills are low, and we've tried mail. I compliment Social Security for the sheer commitment in terms of volume, but you have to say that the results have been extremely disappointing. Mail may not be a very effective way to reach this population. The asset test is something that we fought very hard to eliminate, and that's proving to be perhaps the biggest barrier. It's wrong for people who have earned a benefit to be denied that help because they've managed to scrape together some savings over their lifetime. It punishes the very behavior that we should be encouraging, and it's proving to be a major disincentive, not only in just qualifying people, but in actually getting them to enroll. You look at the enrollment form. It's a very complicated form. It has a line in it that I understand: by submitting this application, I'm declaring under penalty of perjury that I have examined all the information on this form, and we're going to share this information with other government agencies. So this is a population that's probably receiving benefits elsewhere. You know, the form asks for life insurance, burial questions, burial expenses, you know, difficult information, and we're telling people they could be subject to perjury and they're at risk of losing some other benefits. So maybe we shouldn't be surprised that this has not received the response that we wanted. So I think there are some really serious barriers to outreach. We are committed to continuing this effort at a grassroots level because in our experience, it's only the face-to-face community-based work that's really getting people in. And it's not enough to tell them that the program exists. You have to actually enroll them, holding a hand and walking people through, all the way through. So just information efforts are not adequate at all. So this, I mean, we've learned a lot, and hopefully the experience that we've learned here will help us reach the remaining 3 million, but also help us reach those people in terms of all of the other benefits to which they're entitled and most are not enrolled.
B, you had a comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about a couple of things. No surprise, John. On the perjury question, that is a very standard question that we have on all Social Security applications, SSI applications. And more than 5 million applicants have filed for the extra help. So we've used exactly the same language that exists, even when you file a Medicare application. I just want to clarify, I think there's a misconception that the only thing that Social Security has done is mailings. We have been on the ground. We have formed community partnerships. We are willing to go where people are there. I do agree with John. It takes a variety of ways to reach out to people. You have to get to people where they physically are. So we've gone to HUD housing, community health organizations, and have spent a tremendous amount of time in the community. The issue is what I think John said. It's a difficult population to reach and to motivate. So we have used a variety of ways, and I think there has to be the recognition that it's more than just doing informational mailings.
B, you noted that 5 million have applied, but 1.7 million have been deemed eligible and enrolled. Could you explain what factors are keeping the remainder from being eligible and how much of that is partly the asset levels?
Yes. It's now actually over 5 million applicants that have filed, and we're going to do official numbers at the end of the month, but when I was called, people said, can you come with some numbers? So what I'm giving you is truly interim numbers until we can get to do all the data behind it. And we're also approaching now about 1.8 million that are eligible. Having said that, you need to know even in the numbers, we had close to 900,000 people file that really shouldn't have because they were covered in being deemed or they kept filing duplicate applications because if they go to various events and they'd see someone there, they'd say, sure, let me file. And we've actually spoken to people to find out why they filed multiple applications. And they said, well, we figured it would help us if we kept doing that. That's fine. We have a process, but we have to look at it. So when you looked at that, what we want to do, we've done actually two studies to see why are people not getting the low-income subsidy. And it's very interesting. A lot of the people that have filed have screened themselves out. When we developed the application, we were asked to put a question on there. What are your resources? And are your resources more than $11,500 and $23,000 for a couple? And when you look at that, the advocate said to us, you know, people need to know what your requirements are. And a number of people will want decisions. And it turns out there are at least 7 states that are requiring decisions to allow the pharmaceutical assistance programs to continue. So you need to know there's some patterns in the states that are also driving people to file. So when you look at that, we ran 2 sample studies to kind of see, okay, what are the reasons? And it's very interesting on both studies. We had a number of people screen themselves out already. On one study, about 68% screened themselves out by saying they had too much resources, they were over the resource level but wanted a decision. On a prior study, it was 74% screened themselves out of those that we denied, you know, based on resources. So when you looked at the remaining data, and we did take a look where people itemized their resources, and we actually did a denial, it really, of the 500 cases we looked at, and remember, a high percentage said they had too much, about 52% were based on resources, and it was resources in excess of the resource level. If you look for an individual, it was about 18,000 over the resource level. For a couple, it's about 25,000. The two biggest areas on those that itemized was bank accounts and stocks and bonds. So in looking at it, that so far has been our experience. We'll probably take another look, you know, at it to see, but the studies have been pretty consistent. It varies by 5 or 7 points, but it pretty much has shown. So it's about pretty much equal right now, resources and income, and then we have a percentage that's both resources and income.
And Marilyn, you've done a lot of research on asset levels, income levels, and eligibility for individuals for programs like this. Would you have expected some of these issues from your research, and what would you say about our general way of providing assistance to low-income seniors?
I guess I would have to say that I do think that CMS and the Social Security Administration have tried, given the resources that they have, but I don't think anyone should have been surprised by this at all. First of all, we do know that a lot of people who are eligible don't get benefits, in many cases because they don't show up, so we should have just expected that from the beginning. But I think it's also clear that this was a benefit that was not designed with this population in mind, even though this is the population that people used to kind of justify support for the program in many cases. If you're going to deal with a tough-to-reach population and a very poor and frail population, I don't think that anyone would say random assignment makes a good idea when different plans can have very restrictive formularies. It just would never occur to you if you were starting out with saying, let's protect these folks. I don't think you would have co-pays in mind if you were thinking about this. These people have plenty of skin in the game without any more skin in the game in that sense. And I don't think that you would have a restrictive asset test of the type that people are talking about. Today, lots of people have assets in the $30,000 or $40,000 range, but we have to also remember that they don't have pensions for the most part because they're using savings or a lump sum payment when they retire. And those assets have to be spread out over the rest of their lives. And $30,000 over a 17 or 20-year lifespan is peanuts. But the restrictive asset tests are clearly a barrier. In addition to the 3.2 million who should be eligible who haven't signed up, there are about another 2 million who the initial estimate said would not be eligible on the basis of assets, but whose incomes are substantially below the 150% level. And if you think of the people between 150% of poverty and, let's say, 175 or 200% of poverty, which is not a very high level of income, you're also talking about a substantial number of people who are going to find this a barrier. So I think, in general, we should not be surprised by the tough road that has taken that has been to get more people signed and signed up for this program. And remember, these folks who we want to have special protection for get the advantage of having to apply twice, that they have to apply for low-income protection and they have to apply, in the case of the low-income protection folks, to a specific plan. So this is not a plan that was designed for low-income individuals, even though it was presumably going to help a lot of them. I'm not going to speculate on who it was designed for, though.
Well, clearly, if we look at some of the Medicaid experience with trying to improve enrollment and participation, especially on the programs that tried to extend coverage to children, we've learned a lot from that experience that maybe wasn't as directly applied to the Medicare experience as it should have been about what makes sense, how you get people enrolled. And I don't know, Vern, if you want to just comment on sort of what advice the Medicaid program could have given about participation based on SCHIP and Medicaid enrollment.
Well, Medicaid programs, of course, have a lot of experience enrolling people into plans of one kind or another. I certainly had some battle scars from having done some of that as a Medicaid director some years back. But one of the things that is very clear, even in those states that have mandatory enrollment in health plans, is that it's impossible to enroll someone immediately. Every state that has mandatory enrollment in a health plan has what amounts to a holding period of about 2 months because it takes time to get that enrollment process, the choices to be made, and the enrollment to be effective. But as Marilyn was suggesting, this plan was set up so that it assumed instantaneous enrollment. People signed up, and here we are in a real-time online world, and pharmacists are used to an online, real-time point-of-sale world. And so people signed up, thought they were in a plan, showed up at the pharmacy, and discovered that the records, the system didn't see them there and wouldn't see them for another 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks. And so I think that's really part of the problem that was going on right in the very beginning. And as things are set up, it is going to be a continuing problem. It's inherent in the system as it is now. And that's the reason states are having these programs that they have to kind of be a backstop.
One of the issues, of course, is how do we measure success in this program, and especially success in enrolling the low-income people who are eligible for these subsidies. And I guess since many of us deal in numbers as our way of trying to measure these things, the CMS recently modified its estimates for the total number of people eligible for the low-income subsidies from 4.4 million down to 13.2 million. Perhaps, Michael, you could share with us how the numbers changed and why, and how did we suddenly have fewer low-income people?
Sure. As part of this statute, it requires CMS to do a study of best practices in enrolling this population. So in preparation for that, we looked at the estimates of what the total available population would be. And in doing that, the actuaries decided to make some modifications. One was changing the data source. It changed from the current population survey to the survey of income and program participation. And the reason for that change is that the SIP includes both income and assets, so a change in the underlying data. They also made some modifications on the income that was counted. The initial estimate didn't account for all income, such as KEO accounts, so that was an addition. And the initial estimate was based only on those people who had Part B eligibility. And as you know, Part D is based on people can get it whether they have A and or B. So that was another adjustment. So it was an actuarial change in the estimate. And as we get more data, we'll relook at the estimates moving forward.
Well, clearly, though, one of the issues we've seen as a barrier for the low-income population here seems to be the asset test. Is this something that we're going to see revisited? And, John, is this going to be part of future legislative work that AARP is going to try to engage in?
Well, we're already engaged, and if we have anything to say about it, this is going to be front and center. But I think the prospects, to be real, are not short-term prospects for total repeal. It may be that we have to take a staged approach and get it liberalized first before we can go on to repeal. This is an issue that will depend heavily on who's in the White House and who's in control of Congress. And so it's unpredictable as to when we think we can get it addressed. But we're not going to let this issue rest because, as the figures show, it's just denying the benefit to too many people who absolutely need it. And in our mind, this is the biggest flaw remaining in the legislation. Not to say there's a lot of other things that need to be addressed as well, but this is the biggest one. But it's also expensive. And in a PAYGO environment, even though we don't have formal PAYGO, finding offsets is inevitably going to pit us up against the insurance industry. And as Marilyn suggested earlier, they've had the upper hand for a while. I don't think that will continue, but I do think that there's going to be a real tug of war between allocation of funds. Should it go to low-income seniors, who were the highest priority target group for this legislation, or should we continue to overpay plans who have a lot of political power?
Fern?
If I can just jump in, seeing John with that application form a minute ago just reminded me of an experience that I had. I allowed myself to be trained as an official trainer with the Real for Sure, Honest to Goodness official slides, and I've made presentations on encouraging enrollment to senior citizen communities and churches and so on, and then inevitably counseling individuals. And I remember one lady, a 79-year-old widow, who I sat down with that application and to help her fill it out. She was eligible on the basis of income. It wasn't clear whether she was eligible on the basis of assets because she couldn't tell which ones were countable. But when we looked at it,
it came to be clear that she was within about $1,000, maybe $1,500 of being eligible on the basis. And I said, well, you have a 15-year-old car. You could spend some of your money and qualify. Your house needs a roof. You could qualify. You fix that. She said, no, that's my life savings. That's my security. I'm not going to do that in order to qualify for this. And I just think that this is a significant issue on the assets.
Well, I think the other significant issue is also that you point out the documentation that's required. And what we've learned, again, from the Medicaid experience is that it can be very difficult to pull together all the required pieces of paper in the documentation of where your savings accounts are. And if any of you have ever tried to deal with your parents or with other relatives and locate some of the paperwork you need for processing, you know that it's not always the most organized. And as you reach older and a much more frail population, the chances of having all that in hand are going to get slimmer and slimmer. One of the other issues, of course, is that for most low-income subsidies, as for Medicaid, there's not a automatic eligibility for the rest of your life. There's a redetermination process. And we know in the Medicaid program that we lose many of those who initially come onto the program because of the way in which redeterminations work. What are the plans for the redetermination process, and how are you going to keep people from slipping out the back end of the program during that process? You need one more.
I need more strength than I think I have this morning. Diane, let me just go back to documentation. I do agree with you that people have to put together to know what their resources are, but I think you know we do see one of the barriers is people having to bring documentation anyplace. One of the things we were able to design because of the statute is this is in a testing process for us. Mm-hmm. So you attest to what your assets are and your income. We do a verification with IRS once we have an application. And if your attesting is within range, we never speak to you. So you don't have to come in with the kinds of documents that you have to come in for the SSI program, because we did learn from the Medicare savings experience and some of the other experiences that you want to limit documents. But you are right, the statute does require redeterminations. And it actually requires that within a 12-month period, you have to redeterminate a person's eligibility. And then after that period, it gives the commissioner flexibility to set up a process. So we have flexibility once we have done this first year. And in designing the first year, we actually want to do it as easy as we can, given the fact that we're also still out there trying to get people to enroll and sign up for the extra help. So what we are going to do in August, CMS is actually going to give us data as to the population that is deemed. And the reason we need this information, I think you know people may start off as being LIS eligible from us, but the states are continuing to do Medicare savings programs. So you may have some of our people all of a sudden being deemed by the state. So we will purify our population, and we will be sending them a letter and with a copy of a statement of what we have on our records. And we're basically going to be asking for this first go-around a very simple question. Based on what we have, has there been any changes? If there's no changes, we don't want to hear from people. As a matter of fact, we'll continue the eligibility in January 07 for the entire year. If there are changes, we have them to send back something or to call us, and then we will send them a redetermination form. This redetermination form will just ask them to fill out where the change has taken place. We anticipate, if you look at the number that we've determined eligible, and I can't tell right now what we're going to get from CMS, you know, as far as the deemed population, but we think we probably will see about 20% of the population, you know, telling us that they've had a change. And then what we will do is do the same type of matching that we do with IRS, and the determination will be made for January. At the same time, CMS is looking at the deemed population, and they will be notifying, and maybe Michael can talk about that, they'll be notifying the deemed population, those that are no longer eligible, and telling them about filing for the LIS. So I don't know, Michael, if you want to mention that.
Right. We're going to be looking at our records in July and notifying people thereafter as to their status. So they, B is right. People generally, their status improves in light of this program. They become partial or full benefit duals. The SSI population, for example, is very quickly turns into a partial benefit dual eligible. We'll be looking at that, and then on the basis of that, they will be deemed for 2007. Anyone who no longer qualifies will be notified and told about the low-income subsidy applications. So all of that will happen at the end of the year, and we'll be sharing that information with SSA to further stimulate the outreach around the people who need the who are no longer eligible.
And while I have you, Michael, what about the disability population? We know that there are some particular challenges there. What are you doing for the under 65 disabled to really work on their choices about new drug coverage and making sure that the plans that they're in actually are meeting some of their needs?
Let me talk first about what we're doing to try to improve the prospective enrollment of duals who are Medicaid first and then become Medicare. We're working with the states, and this should be in place in the next month or two, to identify people as they age into Medicare, the 64-year-old, 9-month, so we can prospectively enroll them in a plan, and getting their entire disability file so we can check those people who are beginning, who will soon be on disability Medicare, so that we can advise them in advance of what plan they're being auto-assigned, so then they can look to see if those plans meet their needs, as you heard in the video. And we're, again, working with community-based organizations and advocacy groups that represent different disability populations that have significant drug utilization to assist the people that they represent in making sure that they understand what their options are and what they should be looking for in enrolling in a plan, either staying in the one that they've been auto-assigned to or in making a switch, because they may switch as many times as they need in order to get to where they need to be. So that's.
And clearly what we've heard this morning is that there are lots of different plans that can provide some kind of assistance to the Medicare population, either the Medicaid program, which has eligibility levels that vary by state for the dual eligible assistance, or the Medicare savings programs, and now the new low-income subsidy. Marilyn, what would you say about this conflicting set of eligibility requirements, and do you have any suggestions for how somebody trying to simplify life for the low-income beneficiaries could make it a little easier to figure out which program they may qualify for?
Well, I think that one of the things clearly should be some streamlining of income eligibility. It doesn't make sense to have the Medicare savings programs and the Medicare drug benefit have all of these differentiations. I think that's just confusing to people. There are also other categories, as I understand, where people fell through the cracks. In Florida, for example, if you were on a program in which the Medicaid program was paying for your drugs but you were not technically a full dual, there was a lot of confusion, and so you would go there and think you would be eligible, and they would say no, and you would go to the SSA, and they would say no, and you didn't get coverage anywhere. And I know several people for whom that happened. So I think there needs to be a lot of simplification on those regards, not only for the federal programs, but also in better coordination at the state level in some cases when there are these extra programs. I think another thing in terms of simplification, though, really needs to focus more on the issue of all of the plans that are out there and a lot better information. For example, if you go to the detailed websites of the plans to try to figure out whether or not the drug is available to you, and it will say prior authorization, that can mean anything from as simple as filling out a fax form by your physician and mailing it in, which is usually not a problem, to having someone sitting on the phone for 45 minutes to do it, or in one case that I heard of a requirement that the physician supply 2 peer referee journal articles to justify why this drug was going to be given. these are not the kinds of restrictions that you want to have on low-income individuals who likely don't have physicians who are going to spend that much time doing those kinds of things. And that's not information that they can get until they're actually in the plan and participating. I understand that CMS is going to try, for example, to provide more information and some standardization about some of those restrictions. But simplification, not only for all Medicare beneficiaries, which is important, but particularly for this population, where if they're getting a minimum benefit plan, the minimum benefit plan is more likely to have restrictions than other plans. And as a consequence, it's really important to standardize those restrictions so that people understand what they're getting themselves in for. If you call a hotline for a lot of these plans and you say, what does it mean to have prior authorization? They'll say, don't worry, you're on the it's on the formulary, no problem. And that's not turning out to be the case in many instances. So I think there's been a lot of poor information, and it has concentrated itself in many ways on these folks with particularly major problems. So I think we have to not only look at income and asset eligibility, but also what the plans themselves do and how they operate.
John.
I want to second that, but I do think it's not a matter primarily of disclosure or information. I really think this is an area that requires more aggressive oversight by CMS and by the Congress, because ultimately there are going to be people whose needs change, who may understand what the process was at the beginning of the year and what drugs they needed at the beginning of the year, who are going to be in a different situation later. I don't think disclosure, especially for this population, is anything more than just a first step. You know, it's interesting. We do a lot of work now analyzing European health systems, and we've done a lot of work looking at European drug benefit programs. And one thing that's so striking, of course, is that rather than throw it open with fairly minimal requirements, as this legislation did, most Europeans would expect that their government would actually do a review of how well the plan was prepared to perform and make a judgment about whether that plan could be accepted or not based on that review. And I think that's the kind of thing that we have to get to here, because there are going to be wide variations in performance and responsiveness, and we're already seeing that today. And some of this is unacceptable. Some of this is does not belong in a publicly sponsored program designed to serve vulnerable people. And so I think we're going to have to push toward that, towards getting tougher around performance. And it's not just a matter of disclosure.
And Michael, maybe you could also comment on where the population has had the ability to switch plans, the dual eligibles. To what extent are we seeing the churning there that reflects some dissatisfaction with the plans they've been in?
I just want to mention one thing about the more structured approach to being able to get information about prior auth and other kinds of formulary requirements. The administration has been working very hard with both the medical professionals as well as with plans to come up with an agreed approach to try to have a more straightforward way that physicians can request this information, having heard all of the things that Marilyn mentioned. And there is a lot of energy going into working with the plans to make sure that they conform to the requirements. There will be additional requirements put into the contract for next year. So this is, I think, a very a recognized issue, something that we're trying to work with all of the parties to improve, and something that does need a lot of compliance review over time. So I think we agree with that. Getting there will take all of the work and all of the energy of all the involved parties. Now, will you repeat your question? Distracted myself.
It was in terms of the dual eligible population that has the ability to switch plans.
Yeah.
To what extent are you seeing switches going on, and what's motivating some of these switches?
Significantly, I'd say the switches are because people are in state-based programs that are willing to wrap around the benefit. When we saw, especially at the beginning of the program, people who were in state pharmacy assistance programs who also qualified, they moved a lot of the people from the either auto or facilitated enrollment. They worked within their state programs to help those populations find plans that they thought would work better with the state in providing additional support. There is a less number of people who do it on their own.
Do we know how many of the duals actually have switched from their auto assign plan?
I believe the last time I looked at the number, the total number of switchers, that's across everyone, was about 1.7 million. But we can get the actual number.
Number. Okay.
Just one other thought, which is what we're hearing is a lot of people switching when they run into a formulary barrier or lack of coverage, and they're switching into plans that have broader choice. And it's big, at least it was initially.
So we've hit on a lot of issues so far: participation, switching, churning, coverage through the plans, the availability of the low-cost plans, which the low-income population has to enroll in, and future challenges. And you've been very patient listening to us, so now we're going to open it up for you to be able to pose your questions to the panel. If you would please identify yourself so that we know who's asking the question, and if you want to direct it at a particular panelist, please do so as well.
Hi, my name is Trish Niemore. I'm with the Center for Medicare Advocacy. I have a question for Vern, and I have a question for B. Disman. My question for Vern is, you mentioned about the time lag, the sort of necessary time lag of processing applications, and yet pharmacists are used to real-time now information. I think that time lag is just a huge issue going forward, for especially for duals and generally low-income subsidy people. And I don't understand why, if we can do some things in real time and you know it now, why we can't do that sort of across the board in terms of daily information sharing. My question for B is, Social Security and CMS have encouraged people to apply at Social Security rather than at the state Medicaid agency, and I have to say it's a position that I do not agree with. But could you tell us what the average and range of time is for processing an application from the time you receive it, whether or not it's complete, to the time an eligibility determination is made? That might be helpful for us in assessing whether that is, in fact, a good route for people to go.
Okay, I'll jump in on the real-time versus batch process. First of all, thanks, Trish. It's an excellent question, and let me just say, great work on the studies that you're doing in this area. The system, the way it works now, the Medicaid agencies transfer a data file once a month, and then the federal agency matches that up, and then the information gets transmitted back to the plans. Depending on the timing of a switch or the timing of actual enrollment determination or eligibility determination, it could be 3 or 4 weeks before, from the time the determination is made until that information is transmitted, and then another week or two before it actually gets online so it's accessible by the pharmacist when a prescription is actually dispensed. There may be ways to actually use the technology which is available to make this real-time online the kind of world that we're all kind of used to these days. But that's a technology fix which is a little ways down the road. There may be other ways of doing it. And I mentioned earlier the state's experience with mandatory enrollment and managed care. In those situations, states always have a fee-for-service payment system. And it would, of course, be possible to have a holding plan, for example, that might pay claims in an interim until the other process works its way through. So there are ways to address it, but we do have this problem now, which is going to persist, and which I think will we're going to have another a bump of issues which will come up at the beginning of 2007. It was mentioned, you know, there will be a different set of plans, there will be a different benchmark because there will be different bids, so there will be a different set of benchmark plans. There will be, by definition, the way the system works, a lot of changing that goes on around the first of the year in 2007, and I think we may quite possibly see some of these issues arise all over again.
And be on the processing time.
on the processing time, basically, and we've said this, it really depends, but on average, it's under 30 days. To give you a sense of what the biggest component of that is, and if you look at us right now, we have less than 2 weeks' worth of work on hand. The biggest part for us is to get the verification from IRS that verifies the income and asset level. That is not a real-time system, so that data is not available to us. There's some turnaround with that. But if you look at it on average, it's been under 30 days, and looking at what we have currently in hand, it's just about 2 weeks' worth of work that we're sitting with.
In terms of the individuals who are coming through the door to apply for the low-income subsidy, how many are coming through the Medicaid door as opposed to Social Security?
I could only tell you that versus state decisions that they've made. Michael and I have had numerous discussions about it. I think you know CMS did encourage them to use the Social Security LIS application. So we don't keep track of where the application came to us from. But as far as individual states making state decisions of LIS, Social Security received from CMS about 343 of those kinds of decisions. Most were deemed. And so only 43 decisions were actually made by the states, and most of them are in one state.
Okay. And we have a question in the back.
Hi, I'm Julie Robner from National Public Radio. This question is for anybody who can answer it. The people who are signing up for the low-income subsidy but not getting it, can they then not apply, or can they not sign up for coverage until next year? Does that deadline extension not apply to them? And also the people who are currently in the pipeline in this 30 days who may have signed up, who may have applied for the subsidy before May 15th and end up being turned down, what happens to them?
The first group, people who apply for the low-income subsidy and are found eligible, may enroll in a plan. We have established what we call a special election period so that they can enroll after May 15th. And the reason for that is that their status has changed, and we didn't want to have them have to wait until the next open enrollment period so that they may apply. We're also expecting that in the near future, we intend that they will not pay a late enrollment penalty, because that also is part of the statute. So that group of people is well taken care of as we move forward. The people who apply for a low-income subsidy and are not found eligible will have to wait for the open enrollment period unless they qualify because they move out of their area or some of the other qualifications. They go into a nursing home. There are some exceptions for people who may enroll before the next open enrollment period.
Hi, I'm Michael Gluck. I had two quick questions, one a little bit more of an issue, and one more of a comment. The issue of disclosure and non-standard definitions of prior authorization is definitely not limited just to Medicare Part D. And having witnessed a state legislator is trying to grapple with these terms and trying to regulate prescription drug benefits in California a year ago, it was sort of an interesting window on what I suspect is going to be played out at the federal level, and also will be interesting to see if this is an area where Medicare begins to lead the private sector and and in standardizing some of this the terminology. The question I had was really just sort of a quick one, not remembering the details of the MMA very well. For B, how is SSA compensated for the work, the outreach, and other work that you're doing compared to how the traditional draw that you had on the Medicare trust funds? Is it increased resources, and how much, and
Well, as far as doing the MMA implementation, yeah, there was special money that was given to Social Security for fiscal 04 and 05 to implement the major parts of the Medicare Modernization Act. There's other aspects of it that still are forthcoming. In addition, as part of our budget request, we do indicate what we believe our costs will be for MMA. That's part of the overall budget request. There is no separate line now. Our commissioner has made MMA implementation a priority within Social Security. So we do know that whatever we need to do, we will handle the MMA but we do have to look at it as the totality of resources now that comes to SSA. Okay.
Hi, I'm Ann Sherlow from Mathematical Policy Research, and my question is how the institutionalized population has fared with the enrollment in Part D.
I can tell you what we've done to assist them, and then others can speak about what they've observed. We worked very closely with the long-term care industry to identify ways to make sure that they understood who within their population was a dual eligible and would be auto-enrolled into what plan they would be enrolled. We did a lot of pre-work to assist them so they could assist their residents. In making sure that that worked. We have a continuing association with the long-term care industry to identify other issues as they occur and to remedy them. People who then become, and there's also, as I mentioned before, a special election period for people who become a resident of a nursing home so that they then can enroll if they haven't enrolled before. So we are doing things targeted to that group, making sure that they have what they need. There is a significant effort to continue to understand what's different in the way that long-term care facilities and pharmacies administer the benefit and making sure that that's facilitated. So there is a particular focus on that group.
I'll just say that this was an area that we were especially concerned with going forward. And I must say, given what could have happened, it seems to us that there have not been as many problems as we had feared. Not to say it's completely smooth, but we did a survey a couple of weeks ago around the country just asking, you know, what the experience has been. And amazingly enough, perhaps in part due to the outreach that Michael refers to, it's a better picture than we had feared. So I would give a lot of credit to those who have been involved in trying to work out those problems for the very most vulnerable beneficiaries.
And I would simply second that. Prior to implementation, Medicaid directors raised this always as an area of potential issue. But after implementation, it has not really come up as an issue.
Next question.
Jan Heinrich with Health Policy R&D. I'm interested in the performance measures that you're using at CMS now to hold plans accountable. And John, you mentioned the need for oversight. Could you say something more about what you would hope would occur?
What we're doing now on performance metrics are to look at things that they're sort of classically process measures first to see what is happening, things like what is the quality, what are the results on customer service calls, you know, are people able to get through, are they getting the answers that they need in a timely fashion? Are we getting the data that we need from the plans in a timely way? Some of it talking about the making sure that we have the information timely on how people can file pharmacy claims. That's part of the issue that Vern mentioned, and so that's a significant issue for us in requiring compliance with plans to turn that around as quickly as possible and to get that to us so that we can get the information. There are also some other data sets that we need from plans on a regular basis, and we want to make sure that they have a very high level of agreement with us on their enrollment and their low-income subsidy information. And now it's at 97%. We want it to stay at the absolute highest level possible because that's what happens and what's important when people go to use the benefit. So it's those kinds of process measures. And as we move forward and as we develop or complete the contracting requirements for 2007, there'll be additional measures like that. But I think in the near term, you'll see mostly process measures.
John?
Yeah, and I think one thing that we need to pay a lot of attention to is just complaints. And as we hear more and more complaints, at least from some of the plans, about slow reimbursement to pharmacists and the problems that that causes or slow resolution of issues, it's going to be obvious that some plans are performing at a much higher standard than others. And we just need to stay on top of that. So I don't have a complete list of all the things we should measure, but I do think that now that we seem to have gotten through the enrollment piece, actual delivery of the benefit is something that we're going to have to pay a lot of attention to because there are problems.
And Diane, could I just add something to that? I certainly didn't mean to imply that I think that disclosure is all that's needed. I think there are a lot of things that are needed. But I think that we also have to recognize that when the Congress decided that it wanted to go with a private plan approach, they were essentially endorsing the ways in which private plans save money. And the way in which they save money on prescription drugs is through formularies, through other kinds of restrictions, requirements for step therapy, and so forth. So we're going to see a dilemma at some point about then what's going to happen in terms of cost savings over time versus these restrictions. I don't think we're going to see them as much right now. I suspect the plans in many ways are on their best behavior relative to what we're going to see because of the protections that are in there for the next couple of years when plans are supposed to actually be more at risk than they are now. And when and if drug prices continue to rise, then we're going to be concerned about that. So I'm not so sanguine that it's going to be easy to limit some of the kinds of restrictions that prescription plans place on access, because the instant response will be then don't expect us to hold down costs. So I think this is going to be a push and pull struggle that's going to go on for a long time.
Hi, I'm Betsy Korna from U.S. News and World Report. And I wanted to know, we're hearing stories about low-income subsidy beneficiaries who, even though they enrolled months ago, are still not showing up as low-income subsidy when they go to pick up prescriptions. And I want to know why that's still happening and what's being done about it.
We had experienced some issues initially in the implementation of the program of having dissonance between what we had and what the plans had on the low-income subsidy. And as I mentioned in my answer on the performance metrics, that's something that we have spent a great deal of energy on, making sure that the plans have access to the most current information on who is enrolled in their plan and what their subsidy status is. We make that available to the plans not only through a regular file that we send them, but also they can go into our system at any time and pull down their enrollment and low-income subsidy status. And since we've been able to do this, we have much higher agreement between us and the plans. As I mentioned, it's at least 97%. So I think some of that was the consequence of early implementation issues.
Vicki Gottlisch, the Center for Medicare Advocacy. One of the issues that we're seeing are people who were eligible for Medicaid last year based on spend down because they had a lot of prescription drug coverage. And they will not be eligible for Medicaid this year maybe in future years because the low-income subsidy has reduced their prescription drug costs. So I have questions for many of you about that issue. Vern, is that something that the state Medicaid agency directors are seeing and are concerned about? John, is that an issue that AARP is concerned about? If you all recall, in the discount drug card, the $600 did not count towards Medicaid eligibility. And Michael, one of the concerns that we have is for this population, they'll lose Medicaid, they'll lose low-income subsidy. They will not be in a plan at the beginning of next year because they can't afford it. They'll meet their spend down. They'll be auto-enrolled in a plan, and then they'll be stuck with a penalty because they had some months without drug coverage. Has CMS begun to think about that issue and possibly think about any ways to waive penalties for that population?
Well, let me just jump in, first of all, on the medically needy. Medicaid directors have said to me over the last couple of weeks that they are seeing a drop in the number of age, blind, and disabled persons enrolled in Medicaid who have had eligibility related to being medically needy. And it's a predictable response in the sense that a number of individuals attained Medicaid eligibility because of the cost of their drugs, and now then that's covered under Part D. But it is definitely happening. And in fact, it's interesting because when you look at an expected response, which was there might be a woodwork effect as people came in to apply for the low-income subsidy and might be found eligible for Medicaid,
And certainly that might be happening to a certain extent, but no Medicaid director I've spoken to has said that there's a woodwork effect that they are seeing. It may be that it's being swamped by this other drop in coverage of persons who are covered as medically needy. This issue is especially coming up in the mental health community because a lot of folks with behavioral health issues and who are in the behavioral health mental health system in states have had Medicaid eligibility in this way.
John?
I just have this visual memory of one time with Bill Thomas, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, pulling out both of his pockets. And we were talking about this issue. He says, well, you know, I've got two pockets, a Medicaid pocket, a Medicare pocket. You know, I'm switching from one to the other. And you can make a case that that's good for Medicaid. It takes the pressure off the system. But I'd be interested in more information about the impact on the individuals involved. But this was anticipated, as Vern said, and you know, we're switching people from a welfare system to an insurance system. That should be good for the most part. The question is, what's happening at the individual level?
And Michael.
And to answer your question on the late enrollment penalty, we haven't looked at this particular issue yet because it hasn't presented yet. There are, as many of you know, lots of people looking at the late enrollment penalty and what needs to happen in the future. Should it not change, should the rules remain the same, then when something like this were to happen, we would look at it in the same way that we've been looking at the LIS population and their change in status and seeing if there's a way to deal with waiving the late enrollment penalty because of change in status.
Okay. I'm Diana Porter with the Alliance for Retired Americans. Best wishes to you, Michael, on your retirement. Hope you do something very fun after you retire. You explained why the numbers for the low-income subsidy population is different because you went to a different data source. I don't understand why you would change horses in midstream. But on the dual eligibles, you also changed your numbers, and it seems like that's different. The dual eligibles were not an estimated population. They would have been a known population because they were already on the records. And just lately, the numbers for dual eligibles has come down from 6.4 to 5.9. So what has happened to a half million dual eligibles?
Let me just address the first issue. In changing the data source, the data source was changed because it was felt to be a more fulsome data source. The SIP includes assets and income, and that was why the decision was made. I've worked with the Medicare actuaries for a long time, and they look at estimates on an ongoing basis and try to make them as robust as they can. And as we move forward, they're likely to adjust estimates. The dual number is based on reality. I mean, that's something where we actually have tangible information. We're getting information from the states. We put a lot of energy, we meaning the states and CMS, in getting the data feeds right so that as we implemented the program, we would be able to do the auto assignment. So the dual numbers are based on experience.
Daryl McKigney with Long-Term Care Pharmacy Alliance. There was a suggestion earlier that there were no problems in long-term care. I wanted to spell that a little bit. The reason why you don't hear about the problem is that the nursing homes and the pharmacies have sort of eaten, you know, tens of millions of dollars of drugs that are still not covered. And if you saw CBS News last week, there was a report of a medical director who takes care of 300 dual eligibles, and he says he's having trouble with prior authorization on 100% of them and has had to send some people to the hospital. So it's a serious issue. We think part of the problem is that under the CMS marketing guidance, there is a prohibition, which was reinforced last week in a letter to state surveyors, that says that the nursing home, the pharmacy, the doctor cannot tell people if they're in the wrong plan and suggest to them that they enroll in another. And wouldn't it make sense to allow those caregivers to help those people?
Michael? I'll put you on the spot on your last
right,
day.
That's okay. There are some apparent and inherent issues in having people who have an potential financial interest in giving, directing, and people to a plan. And part of the push-pull, I think Marilyn mentioned, there are a lot of them in Medicare, and whether it's this part of the program or others, and trying to balance with where is the right position. How do you make sure that people get the benefit and that is of the most use for them, as well as not putting them in a position of being vulnerable to other interests? And so that's the balance there. In discussing that balance, I'm sure that you and others will have an opportunity to try to influence it and try to figure out what the right protections are, because we're all here, and I truly believe this, and to try to make sure people get the benefits to which they're entitled.
And on that note, I think we've shown you today that it's a complicated population that faces this low-income subsidy and the dual eligibles, particularly vulnerable, sick, low-income, but they're going into a complex program. And I want to thank all of our panelists for shedding some light on some of the issues, and I hope this helps us work toward better solutions in the future. Thank you to our panel.